Think climate change is a dead issue in America? Think again. Around the country, cities, states, and big companies are throwing their weight behind climate solutions, setting ambitious policy and investing hundreds of billions of dollars. While federal policy is bogged down in politics, how are these actors keeping America in the game on this critical global issue? Stay tuned for an upcoming special branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by Citi. We'll hear from Ed Schuyler. He is the Executive Vice President for Global Public Affairs at Citi, and Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, about the policy and financial tools we have to meet the scale of our environmental challenges. Listen for that episode on September 5th, wherever you get this podcast.
Today, we're headed to Congress, and we're going back in time. It's 2009.
Cap and trade.
Cap and trade.
Cap and trade.
Cap and trade.
Cap and trade is actually cap and tax.
The cap and trade plan is as hard to follow as an episode of Lost.
The cap and trade bill. Cap and trade means a system that caps carbon emissions and uses market forces. It creates a carbon market.
Well, in 2009, it was sort of the perfect storm for climate change.
That's Politico reporter Darren Samuelson.
You had Barack Obama as president of the United States, Democrats controlling the House and the Senate. And for climate change, this was seemingly a good thing.
Meanwhile, Washington could be one step closer to tackling climate change.
But I do remember Energy and Commerce went to town and just started writing a very complicated bill, the Waxman-Markey bill. They wanted a carbon cap. That was the most important thing, was to get a limit on emissions with the expectation that would drive industry to reduce, you know, its pollution over the course of a period of time. And so it passes out of the Energy and Commerce Committee. And then there's like fights in the Agriculture Committee where they need to win over the Agriculture Democrats to get their support, all with the goal to try and get the votes on the floor of the House of Representatives. And they ultimately succeed 219 to 212. It was an incredibly close vote. They win, I think, 7 to 10 Republicans who actually joined them. They lost a whole bunch of Democrats. I remember it well because it passed, the day after Michael Jackson died.
About Michael Jackson, the king of pop.
It's seared in my brain because here was finally this big, big moment in the climate policy world where, like, you know, it's going to be national news. It's going to be on CNN, you know, all day. Michael Jackson dies, and it's knocked off the top of the news. And like the next day, when they actually do pass it on the floor, I'm sure it was on CNN for those hours, but back to Michael Jackson coverage immediately thereafter. And when we come back from the August recess and into the fall, that's when, you know, all eyes are on the Senate and what's going to happen there. Who are the key players? And in the Senate, again, you need 60 votes. Democrats are in charge. They did have that supermajority, but the problem was always that there was like 12 to 15 Democrats that were not going to support this without major concessions.
I just will not support cap and trade.
The cap and trade legislation basically picks winners and losers.
Do you believe that a cap and trade system can pass the Congress in this session of Congress?
No.
Harry Reid finally pulls the plug. He says, I remember the quote was something like, I took eighth grade math and I could count the votes and we don't have 60.
It's easy to count to 60. We learned to do that. I knew it. I could do it by the time I was in eighth grade. We know that we don't have the votes.
A large number of Democrats lost seats in the House of Representatives in 2010. Some of the leading voices on that cap and trade bill. And maybe if there was one ad that sort of epitomized the whole thing, it was actually not from a Republican. It was Joe Manchin running for a Senate seat in West Virginia.
I'm Joe Manchin. I approve this ad. Because
who actually, with his gun, shot a copy of the cap and trade bill on television.
I'll take dead aim at the cap and trade bill.
And that ad went viral and showed, you know, sort of that there was bipartisan opposition to cap and trade coming from the likes of a West Virginia Democrat who figured that the only way he could win in West Virginia was to say, I killed the cap and trade bill with his own bullet.
From Politico, this is Global Translations. I'm Louisa Savage. Politico's congressional energy and environment reporter, Anthony Andragna, is here to help me with this week's podcast. Anthony, thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So how long have you been covering energy policy on Capitol Hill?
Well, I first started covering this beat in 2012, which was shortly after the failure of the cap and trade bill. But I think it's really important to go back and look at that fight, as we have here, to understand sort of where the politics of climate change have been over the last decade and why it's such a thorny issue on Capitol Hill where it's been so hard to make any progress. I mean, there hasn't been a significant comprehensive bill considered on climate change since the failure of that bill.
So take us to the present day landscape on Capitol Hill. Is it as divided as it seems?
In some ways, yes. Climate change remains a really thorny issue on Capitol Hill. But I think what we're going to explore today in this podcast is how things are beginning to shift a little bit. Republicans aren't spending as much time this year, some Republicans, aren't spending as much time this year questioning the science of climate change and are instead looking at what might be done about it and what solutions they might offer to address the problem.
We keep seeing the tweets and the rhetoric from the president that do not support climate change as an issue, as a problem, as a policy area to be fixed. But are you saying that Republicans at the congressional level are engaging more?
What I'd say is that President Trump represents a block of the Republican Party, and that block is still pretty resolute in its skepticism about the climate science. But there's a number of senior Republicans on Capitol Hill that have been a lot more outspoken about acknowledging the science and shifting the attention to what the solutions to climate change should be.
Well, can you walk us through what the different factions are right now among lawmakers on Capitol Hill?
The factions on Capitol Hill in this area. I think there's still a significant block of Republicans that are probably more skeptical of the science. They may acknowledge something's going on, but question whether it can be established to what degree human activity is contributing to that. Harder to define, but certainly the hardcore members of the president's base. There then is a block of Republicans that are more openly willing to acknowledge the science and say, something's going on here, human activity is driving this problem, and we as Republicans want to do something about it. And what that's tended to translate to is the need to innovate, to pour money into research and develop disruptive technologies that can figure out a way to capture and store carbon and to otherwise address the issue that way. There's a really small block of Republicans that have put forward more ambitious solutions, some things like a carbon tax. And they found partners with this more block of moderate Democrats who say, we want to do things that are sensitive to the economy, that still take aggressive action to combat climate change, but don't go as far as what the other block of Democrats, those that champion things like the Green New Deal, those Democrats really want to do things on a rapid timescale, decarbonizing the U.S. economy, the electric grid within 10 years, which is a pretty ambitious goal, and getting the entire country to net zero emissions by the mid part of the century.
Are there any Republicans at all on Capitol Hill who would sign on to the Green New Deal?
No.
That's a very precise answer.
Yeah, it's the truth. So I talked to three lawmakers who represent kind of three of the main factions on this issue that we've been talking about.
We plugged in, turned on.
One is this super progressive guy who wants to take immediate, rapid action to address the problem.
My name is Earl Blumenauer.
The second is a centrist, kind of coalition-building Democrat who wants the market to sort of drive the day here.
Hi, I'm U.S. Senator Chris Coons from Delaware.
And the third is a Republican who's really interested in actually taking aggressive action through something like carbon pricing.
Francis Rooney, representative for District 19, Southwest Florida.
So first we have Earl Blumenauer, who's been a longtime congressman from Oregon. He's very liberal. He wants to take immediate, decisive action on climate change. Earlier this year, he introduced a resolution declaring climate change a national emergency with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders.
These young people are amazingly articulate. Watching what's happening at the grassroots level, I find encouraging. It's not enough. It's not fast enough. But I think once those dominoes start to fall, there's tremendous opportunity. That's one of the reasons why we introduced the resolution declaring a climate crisis, an emergency that requires Congress to finally act.
So that's kind of his perspective on this.
The experience dealing with cap and trade back in 2009, I think suggests, first of all, complexity is not our friend. Arguably, the various carve-outs that were created with the cap and trade program was very hard to explain to people. Ultimately, I'm absolutely confident if we had enough time to be able to work with people, they'd understand that the average person would have been better off. But you don't have that amount of time. And when you have so many exemptions and carve-outs and changes, you get lost. I think the argument is probably looking at things that are simpler rather than more complex.
Next, I talked to Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, and he's one of these guys that sort of operates in the center of the pitch.
I work across the aisle as much, if not more, than any Democratic senator.
Last Congress, he offered a bill with Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona that was a carbon tax.
Recently, there are more Republican senators willing to talk about the urgency of addressing the obviously changing climate. But coming to some agreement about what's the right mechanism, what's the right timeline, and how do we do it in a way that also then helps advance American innovation is a real challenge and a persistent challenge.
So he's really looking to find a middle ground that Republicans and Democrats can get behind and that are going to offer market-based solutions that offer predictability to businesses to address climate change.
We recently had a day where more than 70 CEOs came and lobbied on a bipartisan basis, members of Congress, and I convened an off-the-record conversation with seven of them and invited a wide range of members. And I got a number of Republican House members and senators, and we had a terrific and constructive conversation. Most Republicans represent states where there is not yet a strong consensus around action on climate change, and most Republicans are more influenced by the concerns of the fossil fuel industry, skepticism about the urgency and efficacy of work together to confront climate. And so we see relatively few Republican members of the Senate and House who are willing to step forward and say, we've got to do this, let's get to it. Privately, there are many more who see this as a challenge than publicly are so far saying this. The change in direction in the fossil fuel industry in terms of now being willing to endorse movement on climate is a big deal, but it is not yet big enough.
So what does someone like Senator Coons think about the Green New Deal?
I think he's representative of this block of Democrats who appreciate the energy and the enthusiasm that the Green New Deal has brought to the climate debate, but who view it as sort of an unworkable blueprint without a lot of meat on the bones.
I think it's helpful for there to be clarity in my party that there is a huge amount of enthusiasm for taking bold action. I think it's been distracting in that the Green New Deal really isn't an actionable legislative agenda. It is a very broad, somewhat gauzy framework, and it has led to a great deal of partisan sniping and infighting over what it is and what it isn't. What I've tried to do is to reduce the bold ambition of the Green New Deal to a series of enactable concrete pieces of legislation and lay out a framework for here's what we can actually get done.
And then I talked with Congressman Francis Rooney of Florida. He's somebody who is openly voicing support for a carbon tax, which is really unusual, even among Republicans that acknowledge the science now and want to pursue solutions for climate change.
I would have been a lot smarter to listen to my team over here and call it a fee. But once they get through the idea that it is just a form of tax and that it's not a sales tax or an income tax, and it has a direct relationship to a targeted industry, which is the major polluter, at least of the CO2, they get a little more understanding of it. Still not 100% approval. Some people get it, are more accepting of it than others.
And he represents sort of an interesting lone wolf figure in the Republican Party right now.
Well, I wouldn't say that my decision to be the only Republican to push a carbon tax has been unanimously received in our district. But I've tried to explain it and educate people why. They may not agree, but they can appreciate my reasons, I think, and try to raise awareness that we have got to do some things to put less CO2 in the atmosphere. Regardless of the degree to which man may or may not be causing climate change, more CO2 in the atmosphere can't be good. And so we have an opportunity now with the abundant natural gas that we have to stop burning coal. It's 6 to 7 times dirtier. Natural gas is a lot cleaner. And carbon tax will take care of that problem.
What sort of reaction have you faced at home from being more outspoken on this issue?
Well, it's been a process of doing my job, trying to educate people in our district why I'm for certain things and what I think the ramifications are. urging them to do certain research and understand it, and to realize that we are kind of in an epicenter for the environment where we are, both about sea level rise, about bigger storms, about damage to the water, you know, the red tide and the pollution in the water, things like that. And we, no one has more at stake than us in Florida in protecting the environment.
Do you ever worry that that opens you up to a primary challenger, for example?
I don't worry about any of that kind of stuff. I'm here just to do my job. I ran for this job. I certainly did not need a job. I ran for this job to try to accomplish a few things for District 19 that I didn't think anybody else could do. And I'm working real hard at doing that.
What's interesting about Francis Rooney of Florida is he's relatively new on Capitol Hill. I mean, he only got there in 2017. We don't know how long he's going to be around. But he sort of missed the last decade of all this going on. And he acknowledges that while he may take some heat back home for this position on a carbon tax, he thinks it's the right thing to do. And he's hearing from a lot of businesses that also want it to happen.
I don't understand what it is about people in politics that they seem to be immune from some of these large shifts in opinion out there in the real world. I mean, almost all the large company CEOs are for taking reasonable steps to deal with climate change and sea level rise. They're very concerned about CO2 and glacier melt. They're for minimum wage.
And so why do you think that message isn't breaking through with some of your colleagues?
It's very frustrating. It really is. I mean, it's. I don't know if it has to do with campaign finance, if it has to do with entrenched ideology, or if they've just been hearing the same thing for so long, it's hard to pivot.
Well, for you guys, it's an economic issue as much as anything.
Of course it is. It's an existential threat, both to the quality of life and to our tourist economy.
How big is the tourist economy in your district?
Oh, wow. It's billions. We've got those statistics somewhere. I mean, Florida is nothing but tourism.
That's what I find so interesting is the idea of a carbon tax or some kind of a price on carbon is really an economist's idea, right? I mean, this is an idea that is supposed to take the government out of micromanaging how do we reduce carbon emissions, how do we make climate targets, and leave it to the private sector simply by saying, let's put a price on carbon and let's allow the most efficient businesses to figure it out. Why has it been so resisted by pro-business Republicans?
Because the idea of taxing anybody for anything is sort of anathema in Washington right now. And there's been a really successful movement for the last couple decades at making any sort of new taxes, again, likely to trigger a primary challenge for Republicans in D.C. And I think they very much feel that. There was a vote last year on the House floor where they decried the idea of a carbon tax, and they even got a couple Democrats vote for that. So it just shows how politically potent and how politically poisonous the idea of new taxes for anything is in Washington right now.
That sounds exactly like what they're trying to do in Canada and what we discussed with Environment and Climate Minister Catherine McKenna.
We brought a price on pollution, and I will say that is challenging politically. But the price on pollution is critically important to any credible climate plan. You have to price what you don't want. If it's free to pollute, there will be more pollution. I say this to folks, like you can ask a 10-year-old, if it's free to pollute, do you think there'll be more pollution? And it's a market measure where you can make choices. And the way we've done a price on pollution, which I think is, I think the right way for Canada, we said if provinces, look, this is what you need to do. This is the standard. You can decide whether you do a direct price or you, for example, join California, you create a carbon market. And if you don't step up, we're going to step in. And so sadly, and I say this with regret, for conservative politicians, provinces, they have all said they want to make it free to pollute. So we've had to step in. But by law, all the money has to go back to the province. 90% goes back to people.
I wanted to move to the political topic. It seems that a challenge for your government is being a centrist party with a sort of, I don't know, a Goldilocks approach, where on the one hand, you're taking a lot of climate measures, you're bringing in a carbon tax, but at the other side, you're also committing to building new pipelines to bring Canadian oil to new markets. So that you're getting criticized from the right on the climate measures, and you're getting criticized from the left on the pipeline. Is it difficult to be a centrist right now on this issue as we're moving towards more and more political polarization?
I don't know if it's a Goldilocks approach. It's just kind of like, you know, this is how we have to move forward. And there are no magic bullets. Like, there's no wand I can wave and say, we're going to tomorrow, not be a natural resource-based economy. We're going to say we're stopping everything. It doesn't work like that. And you need to land serious policies. And we've got an election, so people will have a choice with what we have put forward. And so my goal is to get people who care about climate action to recognize that we are taking really ambitious action, but at the same time, we're trying to map this out for Canadians. And for Canadians who need jobs, life has to be affordable.
Coming up, how climate change is playing on the 2020 campaign trail and among the business community.
The politics of climate change are frozen in Washington, but beyond the Beltway, action on climate is heating up faster than ever, and you don't have to look far to find it. As America walks away from the Paris Climate Agreement, cities and states are picking up the slack by setting ambitious policy, and so are the world's biggest companies.
A couple things changed. One is everybody started focusing on it, and two is the client demand really picked up.
Ed Schuyler is the Executive Vice President for Global Public Affairs at Citi. In 2014, Citi set a goal of investing $100 billion in environmental finance, and it is about to hit that target 5 years early.
One of the reasons we're able to get to $95.5 billion is because the client demand is there for sustainable transportation, for clean water, for green buildings, sustainable energy, which has increased much sharper than we had forecast.
The advanced energy economy, that's wind, solar efficiency, green buildings, electric cars, and biofuels, are a $238 billion yearly market. That's nearly the size of America's aerospace industry. Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg says all this activity is proof that America is still a leader on climate change, despite the inaction in D.C.
We need action now. And companies started to be much more worried about the environment. Their customers wanted them to do it. Their employees wanted them to do it. And their investors wanted them to do it. And together, we have really done as much as any other country, I think. This world is changing very fast.
I'm Carol Zimmer. Coming up on September 5th, we're releasing our third branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by our sponsor, Citi. We'll hear from Ed Schuyler and Mike Bloomberg about how cities, states, and financial institutions are setting the stage for a radical shift in energy markets and climate solutions. Stay tuned for our final installment of this branded series, anywhere you listen to this podcast.
Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, entered the Democratic presidential race this year to elevate climate change into one of the top issues in the campaign.
For decades, we have kicked the can down the road on climate change. And now under Donald Trump, we face a looming catastrophe. But it is not too late. We have one last chance.
But his single issue campaign didn't get very far.
The worst news at the best place with Rachel Maddow.
I'll make t-shirts.
Inslee dropped out of the race.
Rachel, but I understand that you are here tonight to make some news.
I am. It's become clear that I'm not going to be carrying the ball. I'm not going to be the president, so I'm withdrawing tonight from the race. But I have to tell you, look, I've been fighting climate change for 25 years, and I've never been so confident of the ability of America now to reach critical mass to move the ball. I believe we are going to have a candidate to fight this battle. I'm inspired by the people I've met across the country, the young people in the Sunrise Movement and the climate strikers. These people have given me confidence we can move ahead. So I'm not going to be carrying the ball, but we're going to make sure somebody is.
We wanted to see where some of the other Democratic candidates stand on climate change.
The debate is over. Climate change is real.
Climate change.
Climate change.
Global climate change.
Climate change.
Climate change is real.
So we brought in some of Politico's 2020 campaign reporters to help us out.
Hi, I'm Alina Schneider, and I'm a national political reporter for Politico.
My name is Daniel Strauss. I'm a reporter for Politico, and I cover the 2020 presidential campaign and gubernatorial races.
I think what's fascinating of being on the trail is, without fail, I'd say at least one question is usually brought up in a town hall setting with some of these 2020 candidates asking about what their plan is or how they plan to address climate change.
Look, I mean, it's still the topic is still popular among 2020 candidates, but no one has really found a resonating message that sparks viral moments and has created a windfall of support or endorsements.
And that's what's been fascinating of watching these 2020 candidates on the trail, is how they've tried to reframe some of the rhetoric around climate change, sort of taking it beyond simply devastating our earth, but what are the other ramifications and how can communities combat it? Maybe unexpected communities like farmers, like people who are very invested in climate change because it affects their bottom line and their crops, and maybe hadn't thought of how they might be a part of the solution.
It's still a rather opaque topic in the primary and remains less of a sexy issue for candidates than, say, adding seats to the Supreme Court or Medicare for All. But all of the candidates do agree that climate change is an important issue. It's just a sort of eat your spinach topic right now.
Look, I think that this is the job of the politician, is to try and connect global issues, big problems, and translating them onto an individual level.
I mean, we just haven't seen a candidate who has really articulated climate change in a galvanizing way. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal is sort of the checkmark that a lot of candidates use to say that they're serious about climate change. But Ocasio-Cortez isn't even running for president. She isn't. Climate change is not her sole focus, unlike Inslee, and she still remains sort of the leader on setting the tone and setting the parameters for this debate within the Democratic Party.
Ryan Heath is a senior editor at Politico who has closely covered European politics. He broke down for us where the political parties in Europe stand when it comes to addressing climate change.
So what you have is something very different to the US, where you have even right-wing political parties all on board with the idea of getting eventually down to zero net emissions. And in any case, even in the next 10 or 15 years, really halving the number of climate emissions.
Well, you just said something really fascinating, that the conservative parties in Europe are also on board for taking these measures on climate change to greater or lesser degrees. Why is that? Are there no climate deniers in Europe?
There are climate deniers, and they do overlap heavily with that nationalist and Eurosceptic tendency that a lot of people have been hearing about in recent years from Europe. But the centre-right governing parties are very much on board with the idea that they need new export industries. They know that green parties have been rising up in general, and they want to cut that off. They want to show that there's a conservative way to be green and not allow their general populations to become radical leftists. So this is a very pragmatic point of view from the centre-right political parties, and it takes a few individual leaders to push the boat out as well. So Ursula von der Leyen, who will become European Commission President later on this year, she's not necessarily in the center of her own political movement, but she now has one of these top jobs, and she's dragging her party slightly to the left.
That's really interesting. Do you think having a multi-party system plays a role too? So it's not you're either on one team or the other, but there are these different options?
Absolutely. The fact of the matter is that Ursula von der Leyen is not going to be able to pass legislation at the EU level if she doesn't have the Green Party on board at least some of the time. So it's for her own political survival that she makes these policy concessions on climate. And I think that's a trend we're going to start seeing at the national level as well in more and more European countries.
Given that it is a global challenge, the real solution is fundamentally technology development.
Dan Byers is the vice president of policy at the Global Energy Institute of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Among the business community, and particularly, I think, increasingly so on the Hill, the voices that were skeptical on the climate science issue are really fading. I think there's general agreement on that over the last couple of years. Yes, you have an administration coming in that is where it's not a priority, or they'll make certain statements. But between the business community and in Congress, I think you see a much different environment than you had 10 years ago or even 5 years ago.
But the chamber remains skeptical of the Green New Deal.
What we don't want to see happen is a regulatory mandate, you can name the Green New Deal or potentially some of these other ones, that has no context for what is actually technologically achievable or reasonable for us to proceed upon, because then you'll have an issue like leakage. You're not actually going to be solving the problem. And so that's why we think that the real solution is technology. We think it's woefully underfunded. To give you some perspective, the federal government spends about $30 billion a year on health research, very important. We know that we've collectively agreed as a society that that should be a priority. We only spend about $2 billion a year on clean technology. And so we think that that can be dramatically increased so that we can accelerate a lot of these technologies that we see as essentially being the energy economy of tomorrow.
When you mentioned government funding, that's sort of like the carrot approach. But is that enough without any sticks? Like, don't you need some incentives in the market for or through regulation for companies to actually move more quickly on developing those technologies?
Yeah. Excellent question. And I think we would anticipate that some complement of both needs to be made available. But we believe that the sort of most overlooked part of the debate is the technology side that is going to have to develop something that then can become the next generation best available technology and keep sort of iterating down that path. And we think we can do it much faster than we are right now.
So, Louisa, I think that's a common theme between people like the Chamber and Republicans like Congressman Rooney that we talked to earlier in this episode. Kind of this openness to climate change solutions, but a definite resistance to regulations.
So, Anthony, while we wait for the presidential campaign to play out over the next year, what is next for Congress?
Well, Democrats, fresh off winning back the House in 2018, are in the process of huddling together and trying to write detailed legislation that they can implement really quickly if a Democrat wins the White House in 2020. And in the meantime, I think what you're going to see is there are a couple of small ball bills that may happen this year, things like energy efficiency, weatherizing buildings, and other priorities that have some bipartisan consensus. These are small ball things, but that cumulatively can have an impact on climate change.
All right. And in the meantime, we'll watch and see what happens with the presidential election. Thank you so much, Anthony, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Next time on Global Translations, how will climate change change the world? And how will it transform geopolitics?
The Arctic is really ground zero for the nexus of national security and climate change. In our lifetime, a whole new ocean has opened up because with climate change, the sea ice is retreating, oceans are warming, and the permafrost is collapsing.
Our producer is Annie Reese. We had help on this episode from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. My thanks to my colleagues Anthony Adragna, Ryan Heath, Darren Samuelson, and of course our 2020 campaign reporters. I'm Louisa Savage. Global Translations is presented by Citi, a leading global bank. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you're listening on Politico.com, go to Politico.com/globaltranslations to learn how to download the show to your phone. And listen for a branded episode from Citi about some of these same themes coming Thursday, September 5th. Thanks, and see you next week.